Mr. Jewett, Reel 9. You mentioned bombardment of the Norwegian coast, obviously sailing in the northern seas. What were the conditions on board sailing in such cold climates and such heavy seas?
In a light cruiser such as... Yes, the conditions on a cruiser... Well, the Phoebe was one of the new light cruisers, very fast, 5,000 tons, and she had a complement of boys. As you realise, I was a boy first class, and she was. There were really all what they call all welded ships, and these were comparatively new in the Navy. But at sea, they were pretty rough at sea. Not as rough as a destroyer, but certainly not as stable as the larger cruisers and the battleships, which more or less rolled. Well, needless to say that there was every mod con, as far as you can think about, four seamen and the lower decks in harbour and so forth. She was quite comfortable. They were quite comfortable, and they had great entertainment. There were ship's company were wonderful at entertaining each other. They have the I don't know if I've mentioned it before, but they had the naval's what they call the Sailors Operatic Dramatic Society.
Yes, we've got
and
this.
I mentioned that, and they're wonderful. But the conditions in rough weather, well, it's the same. The sea is the same everywhere on any ship. If you're on a cockle shell whaler, or if you're on a 45,000 ton battleship, the sea is rough, and it's always rough. And it gets in, doesn't matter what kind of ship you've got, it gets in through gun turrets, through, it gets in all over the place, and you get wet. Watches aboard were exactly the same. Naval system, you had cruising stations, which is 4-watch system, defence stations, 2-watch system, and action stations, of course, which is when you're closed up at your armaments. On the Phoebe, I was a boy, I wasn't fortunate enough to be on the guns, because I would have loved, boys are always romantic and they love to be on guns and things like that. I was just a messenger for the damage control headquarters, which in fact was below decks. It's a bit of a two-way, it's pros and fours and against. Now the four side is that as a messenger you would have access to all over the ship. You had to run messages when the communications systems broke down, which was invariably in action. Even telephone communications sometimes broke down, even out of action, let alone going in with guns blazing and so forth. But on the other hand, it was below decks, and if you were torpedoed, you had to fight your way out. You had to know, you know, how to get out of the ship, which is, and self-preservation to anybody is the first thought. Even as a boy seaman, you think of, how am I going to get myself back home to mum? And that's the way it got. And of course the ships do, they go up and down, they yaw, heel and yaw, and go up and down and roll, just the same as any other ship, except perhaps a little more violently. But they were fast, and when a fast ship goes fast through rough weather, then you know all about it. But the boys' mess deck was below decks, and it occupied, I can't remember how many boys there were on it now, about 30 or 40, I should think. There was a lot of boys on the Phoebe. And it's, I don't know if I've mentioned this before, because in actual fact, after I left the Phoebe, I was taken into Mernskirk Hospital at Newton Mearns, and where I was well looked after. It was an emergency hospital, of course, because of the fact that I was injured. But I was taken off with great haste at Greenock, and the ship disappeared. I lost my ship, which, you know, and people, sailors don't like losing their ship. But the denouement, if I can use that word, came a little afterwards, because a few months afterwards HMS Phoebe went to the Mediterranean and was torpedoed. And guess what happened? It was the boys' mess deck which was torpedoed. So somebody upstairs must be looking after me somehow, or must have been looking after me at that time.
Did you suffer again in these seas from condensation and running water?
All that sort of thing goes with as part of the cork. The inside of a warship is lined with sort of a cork material. It's white, but it's cork. And it's supposed to absorb condensation, don't you believe it? It runs down just the same. It streams down, actually, wherever you are. And I believe that the incidence of tuberculosis in the Navy was very, very high, actually, on all ships. In fact, the smaller the ship, the greater the danger, because on a large warship, of course, the compartments are larger and you've got more aeration, more circulation of the air. But on the small ships, such as destroyers and small destroyers and corvettes, things like that, it was pretty horrendous. But on the Phoebe, you've got condensation and stuff, and of course the sea gets in, because even if you open a watertight door, as soon as you open it, a great big wave comes through, and the place is flooded in seconds. You know, so you've got water splashing around all over the place. But as soon as it levels up, or you get back into harbour or towards calmer waters, the crew gets soon dries it out, soon gets cracking again. It's one of those things you learn to live with, you know. It's par for the course, as they say in the golfing terms.
Did it cause a great deal, I mean, you mentioned tuberculosis, but did it cause a great deal of sickness on a daily basis in the ship?
Seasickness is a funny thing. I found that seasickness is curable. It's curable by seasickness. I was lucky. I never was ever once seasick in the whole of my career in the Navy, but I put that down to the fact that I come from a nautical family, and it was my pride wouldn't allow me to be sick. But in actual fact, what happened was people were sick, men were sick on the first day, first 2 days even, perhaps. They'd bring up their insides, they couldn't face it, and they'd usually go green. And normally that was it. They were okay after that. They never got sick again. And usually, once they'd been seasick and been it, they get better and better. And the second time they go to sea, they've forgotten about the seasick. It's only just an experience you've got to go through.
You mentioned the bombardment of the Norwegian coast, which would be April 1941.
That's
that
right,
kind
yeah,
of time.
That's right.
And you were below decks, so you would hear the guns thumping away.
I'd hear the guns going, that's right.
Were you, as a ship's crew, were you informed what you were about to do? And
yes.
You were kept in the picture?
Oh, yes. The captain, once you were at sea and you couldn't do much about it, the captain used to broadcast, in all the ships I was on, the captain used to broadcast the ships, and he would say, now we've left harbour, and we are heading for so and so. We're going to join up with HMS Force Q or whatever force, HMS so and so and so and so. And you'll see the HMS whatever it was on the port beam, and they're escorting us. And we are now going to bombard off the Norwegian coast. And we may or may not meet with the enemy opposition, whatever. Or if they were expecting it. Sometimes the captain was quite on the guy said we were expecting to have a rough ride, you know, or something like that. He would put across. Yes, we were kept informed. The Navy were very good at that sort of thing, actually. But there's one thing I must emphasise that throughout this, if I haven't said already, that keeping a diary was almost a capital offence of the Navy. It was just not done, not on, and everything that I say has got to be from my memory, because I, no way would I ever keep notes of where I've been, what we were doing, what we're about to do. It was just absolutely, well, I should imagine you get about 12 months in the chogi if they caught you, because it wasn't on. And these sailors that kept diaries, they must have been reckless, because it was a naval regulation that you don't keep in wartime. For obvious reasons, you know, because if it fell into the hands of the enemy, well, of course, it's invaluable. You can jeopardise the war effort, because the enemy could work out a pattern, a strategic pattern of what their ships are doing, what our ships were doing.
Were the bombardments that you're taking part in, were they during the Allies or the British getting onto the Norwegian shore, or were they, when they were retiring coming
not
off?
That time. No, no. It was Stavanger Air Corps. Now, at that time, I can't remember now whether the British were still in occupation or not. I think we'd just left. I think they'd been evacuated. And in a naval bombardment as such as that, it's all done. Most of the firing is done. This was at night time, by the way. It was bombarding at night time. It's done by instruments. And,
yes, I think we've got that. The Mercury switch you were telling us about.
That's right. And yes, I think that's about it.
And being in that kind of action, as you say, you were below. With certain tasks to perform if they occurred, it must have been a bit worrying for you to hearing the guns going and.
The first time I think you get it's use. To tell you the truth, one of the things which happened to me in the war was when you first go into action, you've got it's not fear, it's trepidation. I think you really don't really know, but the truth of the matter is. For most people in the Navy, as later on in my service, because that particular job was my first ship, and that particular job was one of the things I didn't like about that job was because I had nothing to do. Whereas later on, when I was in charge of sites, gun sites, and people who are on guns are so busy, they just haven't got time to be frightened. And most people don't know what the hell's going on anyway. If you're loading a gun, a gun with a big shell, 5.25 shell, because the HMS Phoebe was armed with 8 5.25s at that time in twin turrets, and the power-driven turrets. But when you're busy, everybody in a guns crew is so tied up with what they're doing that they haven't got time to worry about anything else. If you don't think about action or fear, it doesn't come into it at all.
And in the damage control centre where you were, and there was no damage because you weren't yet.
They were all shipwrights and people like that. They were all people who were there ready to repair the ship if she got torpedoed or severely damaged with shell fire or whatever. But that's what they were for. They were all shipwrights and people who were, you don't get that sort of thing on smaller ships, but on big ships you get shipwrights and the chippies, as they call them, and they're the sort of people that assess the damage control officer is an engineer. They're the people who assess the damage, and then when you get hit, you try and patch it up as best you can, you know.
And you'll be sitting there waiting for.
That's right, waiting for something to happen, sort of thing, which is not very nice. Actually, it wasn't very. Just sitting. Waiting for an instruction which may never come, sort of thing, you know. You have nothing much to do, but as I say, that didn't last. That was my action stations. But life on the cruiser was very good for boys, though. The boys were very, very well looked after because I had to go to school in harbour.
Yes, we've got that.
Boys, I've got that in there.
Got all that, yes.
I've got
yes,
that. I can't remember how much you did.
A general question now, really at this point in time. Of course, you're a young teenage lad growing up in fit and healthy and amongst a lot of men who were the same. What problems, if any, did the lack of females being around? Because you were encased in that shell, as you were, for a long time, long periods of time.
Well, I think with boys, it didn't matter much. I think we all had girlfriends and that. We used to be sort of bawdy. At that age, I think boys don't worry too much. They didn't worry me, but of course, you know, the Navy were very crafty. They used to put things in our tea, and it used to sort of. They told me, what are they called? Saline. So I forgot what the hell these. They used to put this something in the tea. I can't remember what the heck it was called now, but they put it. They definitely put something in tea. We used to cool down our armour. I don't know if I ever told you. Did I ever tell you about David Treverthy and Thomas? Have I repeated that on the Phoebe, on HMS Phoebe? One of the characters on the Phoebe was a lad called David Thomas, and I became very friendly with David. Actually, he was an ordinary seaman, and he was he was a lad who point blank refused to take a commission. He was extremely well spoken, and I don't know why I took a shine to him actually, because I was a boy and he was an OD, which is much senior to me. But he his father was a director of Shell Mex, and extremely wealthy family. And David used to sport when he used to go to the bathroom. He used to sport a beautiful silk dressing gown with a dragon on the back of it. Which wasn't the sort of things. I don't know if I've told.
Yes, now that you mentioned it, yes,
I did mention it.
We have got that.
Oh, that, when the Rolls Royce came and picked up the. That's right. This is the trouble with you forget out what you've actually said. But that was one of the instances of this Phoebe which sticks out in my memory. It was so hilarious.
But you did mention once you were on the HMS Ganges, the fact that of course Abel Seaman were kept away from you, and then you were very
absolutely.
That was the same on the ship. Wasn't it?
Yes, at no time did I ever come across any cases of sodomy. I mean, I call a spade, and none of that. The penalties were too severe. I mean, if you even touched a boy, you could guarantee you're going to get 12 months in chokey. There's no two. If a boy complained, a young boy complained of a seaman touching him or something like that, oh dear me, quarter deck, locked up, prison before you know, court martial. And that would be it. There was no. That was why I suspect that's probably why nobody ever treated boys with the greatest respect. You didn't muck about in that direction. A lot of banter and fun, but nothing more than that. That's all.
Again, at sea for quite long periods of time, and under various pressures, presumably. How about personal relations in the sense of falling out with each other, arguments, fights, this kind of thing?
Oh yes. Well. On the Phoebe, where we are at the moment, it never occurred. It didn't happen because, of course, I wasn't on the Phoebe that long, as you know, and it never happened. But later on, it certainly did. Actually, it did on the Ashanti. The Ashanti was a very fine, very happy ship. But I'll come to that if you like later on, because either we'll get out of sync, as the saying goes, you know, otherwise if we start sort of leapfrogging back and so on.
Well, we've got your injury and your hospitalisation, and then when you came out, as you said, your ship had gone.
That's right.
What happened to you
then?
Well,
I was still in hospital, and the ship, I went from the, as a matter of fact, one of the things that annoyed me, the one thing they didn't load with my kit, because my shipmates packed all my gear for me, one of the things they didn't put was my... believe it or not, was my ukulele, and I was most upset about that because my parents had bought this ukulele. I used to play the ukulele like George Foreman was all the go in those days, and I used to sing this Mr. Woo and Lorne Triney and When I'm Cleaning Windows and all. So he says, I believe I was not quite a dab hand at it actually, but they didn't pack my ukulele and they were quite expensive. But and I never bought one since, so I never that was the only thing. And after that, I was in Mearnskirk Hospital where I was given very good treatment, and then I was there for 6 weeks, and then I went back to Chatham Barracks, and that's the end of my story on the Phoebe as a boy back into barracks.
And what date was this when you went to Chatham?
I'd have to look up. Hold on, have you got the... Yes, the date that I left the Phoebe was on the 31st of January 1941. So we're now into 41. And
what were you doing in those barracks?
Into barracks. We went into barracks. Now, at that time, there was enormous scare. And boys, same as all the seamen in Chatham Barracks, it was a big, very big barracks. All the boys in barracks were, you've got to remember, very highly trained. We knew bayonet drill, rifle drill and everything, and they put gaiters on us, and we were standing by for an invasion, because it was a possible invasion at that particular time, during the day. Also, air raids, the Royal Naval Barracks Pembroke is a vast place, in fact it's the oldest of the barracks really, the North Command, huge place, and I think about 28,000 I think all sailors there altogether. And the boys section is sort of separate from the men's section, but no better or no worse. We weren't in the main, the main block was for the seamen, but we were separated, a separate part. But at night time, everybody in the barracks used to have to take their hammock, not their kit bag, but their hammock, down into the tunnel. They had these underground subterranean tunnels in HMS Pembroke, and that was a routine. You had to go and sort of take your hammock and sleep in the tunnels at night time. It was so damned uncomfortable, and it was so miserable for people like us doing all this sort of thing, that I think there was no pleasure being in barracks. We used to get home at night time, because I lived at Welling, and it wasn't far easy. It was easy to get home, but it was no pleasure at all. And routines for boys were just the same. They were very strict on training and teaching and training, keeping boys up to date. Because I can understand this, looking backwards, because we were the future of the Navy, war or no war. The boys were the future, the naval officers, naval senior NCOs of the future, and that's quite true. And the Navy were quite wise in this, actually, keeping the training up to date. And there's a sort of a, boys, of course, are always like old men before their time. They try to be three badge APs before they're 17 years old. They try to be about 30, you know. You'd think I would say, with another hat on, a sociological hat, that a boy of 16 or 17 is the most dangerous animal you could come up against, especially a highly trained boy from such as HMS Ganges was. Yes, I think I recall people saying about in the latter part of the war, when Hitler used to recruit the Hitler youth, and some of our soldiers came up against these kids, but it was no joke. In fact, even today in Cambodia and places in the Middle East, there's 12, 13, 14 year old children say, "Oh, how could they? Don't you? They can pull a trigger and kill you just the same as anybody else, and will." When the patriotism is such, and that was the same with us. Times haven't changed at all in that. People haven't changed.
It's the enthusiasm of youth.
That's right. It's that youth and the lack of fear, enthusiasm of youth, of my king and country, glory, death or glory, and all this. This is all in there, and in a young kid, and that's what you know. Most of these kids wanted to get to sea, wanted to get to fight the Germans. You know, rub their hands, let them all come. This is true, as you'll see. When I was on HMS Ashanti, well, I think we'd have taken on the Tirpitz and 15 battleships, German battleships, without any hesitation whatsoever, or thought for what might happen.
Look, presumably on the Pembroke, or at the Pembroke, you...
The barracks, yes.
You were training.
Waiting drafts, yes. Because most the drafts were posted up every day in the drill shed, enormous drill shed, you know, place, you know. Hold about 2,000 people, 2,000 men, and the drafts. You'd soon get to know. You get what they call a draft chit. They'll give you a draft chit, and then you'd see where you're going. And in the fullness of time, I got there were no further qualifications as a boy. You don't actually.
So it was a time of expectation and disappointment, did you?
Yes, more or less. That's right. Yes, that's all you could do. You could sort of you're just waiting for your draft. There's nothing much you could do. But of course, you did know you were useful at that time, because we didn't get formed into platoons or anything like that at the time. But we had been told that we may be needed to be sent up to the East Coast to repel any. So it was a sort of reserve that wasn't talked about very much, but it was there.
Did you suffer bombing raids?
Not a shout, no. Raids, but no bombs dropped while I was there. But London did, I believe. They got one or two, but not at that time. Not in Chatham. I didn't get any. No, but well, I don't suppose we'd have heard it, because these shelters were so deep underground. You'd take an atom bomb to have shifted you. It was enormous, but very uncomfortable though. It was terrible. Hundreds and hundreds of sailors, you know, sort of sleeping in the shelters under there.
You were there about 6 months. Were you becoming bored with it all, waiting for...
Oh no, I don't think as a boy you do get bored. You always find something to do. You know, there's always a lot to do. It's the most interesting place as well, and there's boat sailing and all sorts of things you do. You don't sit around. And every morning, the routine every morning. I mean, you had divisions every morning, and then after your parade you sung a hymn or two, you know, you had your service, you know. Then they used to partition you off for jobs. So there was no boredom. You had to go polishing brasses, sweeping up, picking up, skirmishing, you know, all sorts of weird and wonderful things. And the prize job was at the Rennery. Now, you know what the Rennery is, don't you? Well, the Rennery is where the Women's Royal Naval Service were barracked, you see, and they wouldn't allow men. They never allowed men to go up there, but they always thought that boys, like us, could be trusted. Believe it or not, how wrong can you be? I remember when I was sent up to RM Barracks up there, and I was detailed off to help in the kitchen. I had to help in the kitchen as a boy while I was waiting draft, you know, at the Wren's quarters, you see, in the kitchen of the Wren's quarters. Well, as a boy, I mean, I was completely naive. I got my education completely opened up with that load of young women. Honestly, there were me and a couple of other lads. They absolutely took us to the cleaners. Part of mother experience, which I can't really really go into here, because those young ladies were extremely, I suppose the word is sex starved. I suppose we went there. Could you get out alive? It was a question of not a kind. Could you get out in one piece? Because these young ladies were extremely. Odd to us youngsters, and that's a fact. And that job didn't last because they used to change. I got it for about a week, I think. I was there for about a week, and then the next week I got detailed to do something else, and somebody else had to weed the commandant's garden, and there was all kinds of things. So you weren't bored, you know. You always had a job to do, you know. You didn't sit around looking at each other. The Navy made sure of that, you know, even if it's polishing the guns. But I used to love going to the gunnery school, because some kids used to have to go to the gunnery school. But as I say, the different jobs they changed around, and just to help polish the guns up, you know, polish the brasswork. We didn't need polishing, I mean, but you did. The Navy is like that, you know. Everything shines. If it's still, you polish it, you know, or salute it or something like that.
When the draft list went up and you found yourself on it, that must have been a moment of some excitement.
Yeah, well, exactly. A lot of us see that in the Navy, as a boy, you would. When I got a draft to a destroyer, which HMS Ashanti was, I was delighted. And at that time, was a lot of boys from HMS Mashona. Now, the Mashona had been sunk in the Battle of the Bismarck. She was another tribal class destroyer, and all the boys had been drafted to barracks the same as I was. And I met these lads from the Mashona, and they were saying what a good ship it was, because I'd been on the Phoebe, but I hadn't been on the Mashona. And and that sounded good to me, because there wasn't the bullshit. I'd be on a destroyer. There wasn't the pusser, the drills, and the I mean, on a cruiser, you're in full uniform on a cruiser or a battleship. You're running around, you know, with collars. Whereas on a destroyer, it's always ovals and things. Oh, what a dream, you know, not having to put all that on, you know. And when I got drafted for the Ashanti, I was absolutely delighted. I thought, oh, a destroyer, this is wonderful, this, you know, for a boy to go on to destroyer.